Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our previous episodes on our website, themacguffinman.com. We most recently talked about Game Night. Before that was the Parallax View. Funny Games before that, and First Man before that. But yeah, let's get to the theme song. All right, James. So today's movie, perhaps the most famous person outside of the actors is John le Carré. Carré, I'll probably be pronouncing it a variety of ways throughout this podcast accidentally.
Different regions of France, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. I did a lot of research. Who is a novelist known primarily to people like us. He's probably primarily known for The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, which was adapted into a movie in the 60s, I believe. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which was adapted in 2011. And The Constant Gardener, which I believe was adapted in 2005. And he's known for complex stories that often are spy-based because he's a former spy himself. And they throw lots of details at you. I think Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy might be the most complicated movie I've ever seen plot-wise. But there's not a lot of information. It's sort of like the only color he paints in is gray. No black and white here. And Anton Corbin is a director who in 2014 was doing his third film after Control and The American. But he had had a whole career as a photographer and music video director before that. But this is his third film and sort of the first in a certain kind of style that that is different from Control and The American. And A Most Wanted Man is where these two threads meet. And like the other le Carré movies I've seen, or le Carré adaptations I've seen, there's a lot of information in this movie, and there's not a lot of hand-holding, that's for sure. And I love movies that are almost purposely confusing because I like watching movies multiple times, and I understand that that can be a bit of a tougher sell for some people. But I really like this movie, and I think the fact that sort of post 9/11 as a genre, post 9/11 film genre, you get a lot more misses than hits. And I think this one really does a lot and uses the inherent ambiguity of the quote unquote war on terror really well. And I really love this movie.
Yeah, it's got a good amount of distance. There's 13 years. And so I think it's not very reactionary. And
yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah.
And yeah, I don't think you're very interested in a lot of the jingoistic versions of a 9/11 movie. Mm-hmm. Carré does have a certain, or Le Carré does have a certain style, or the adaptations of his work do, because they're influenced by his works, obviously. And so it is a bit of a combination. Carré, it's so predominantly Cold War throughout his career, and this is just a different struggle. And it has the 9/11 thing is so present in this, but it doesn't feel like a like when you would say a post 9/11 movie. I picture a much different film than this.
Yeah, it is a pretty broad genre. It's different in that, like, say Zero Dark Thirty is another movie that was released a few years or 2 years, I think, before A Most Wanted Man, and that's more like explicitly features into the post 9/11 sort of genre, because it's literally about killing the person who was in charge of 9/11. And yeah, you're right that there is more distance in this movie, even though the ending of Zero Dark Thirty probably happens right around the same time that this movie takes place. Yes. But it's more, well, I guess the place to start is with the first shot of A Most Wanted Man, where we sort of see this still water, where we get the text explaining that Muhammad Atta worked in Hamburg when planning a lot of his role in 9/11. And what we see is water that is still, and then we see movement, there's unseen movement through the water that creates, like, calling them waves is a little bit too much, but like very I guess they are borderline waves, you know, like it's the effect of something moving through the water, right? Yeah. And if and this movie is all about the effect of actions, the effect of decisions, and waves are the effect of moving through water, you know, like that's the cause is walking, is moving through water, and the effect is the waves. And this movie is all about the ripple effects, you know, and the ripple effects of how various countries reacted to 9/11 and how they shifted intelligence ideas. You know, again, I'm going from what I know in Le Carre movies, you know, like I'm not an expert by any means, but just the idea that, you know, we've gotten enough ripple effect and this is where we are in A Most Wanted Man. You're right that there is a remove, but it's sort of like each wave has had influence on the one before it, you know, because it all comes out of the same action.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think the waves is a good metaphor for that. And we kind of just get the sense of like dampness throughout this whole movie, which I think works really well. But it's important that there's not really antagonists in this movie. And so much of the action is people working towards generally the same goal and going about it in different ways. And that's, you know, when you said that it's the effect of 9/11 is these different intelligence communities having different reactions to it and choosing different methods. And that's, you know, a conflict that runs throughout this is just the German style versus the American style, you know, Gunther's small little intelligence community that, you know, that he runs out of Hamburg versus this much bigger, seemingly more reactionary American style. And so they both want to stop Islamic extremism, you know, they're both, you know, generally on the side of the West and preventing another attack being planned in Hamburg or in Germany. But Gunther and his squad want to move up the chain and kind of turn these people to get someone bigger and get someone bigger. And they use the metaphor of the fish, which is understood correctly in this film, just to clarify.
Yeah. I love how he talks like that's the first time he's ever heard any metaphor in his life.
Yeah. As British community would say, a hat wearing a different idea, or an idea wearing a different idea is a hat. And so that's one of the interesting things that lines up with Le Carre is that it's, as you said, it's not this black and white, it's not this good guy versus bad guy, and it's not this zero-sum sort of tug of war where the good guy does this and that has the equal negative impact on the bad guy, and it's this constant battle. It's different methodologies and different ideas about how to reach the same goal here, and that's not always the case with Le Carre. Sometimes, you know, we do have a more of a confrontation, but that moral ambiguity in that, you know, just having those different approaches is just multiple examples of a more complicated conflict at the center of a piece of work. And that's my understanding of the way his books are and the way that his films are. And just reading about this and some of the other ones other films we've seen and talked about, it sounds like Le Carre, who has only recently died, so is alive and somewhat involved in this adaptation, is not really precious about his work. Like, he obviously is very proud of what he does, and he was a prolific writer, but seemed to be pretty hands-off and would help out, but really want to see that these filmmakers have a creative product that's very much theirs by the end. So he writes these extremely long books that are full of detail, and I know you think this movie's full of detail, but just by adapting a 400-page book into a 2-hour film, you're just cutting out so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's such a different product, is my understanding.
Yeah, and so I was listening to Anton Corbin talk about the adaptation process, and one of the main things, I mean, this is true of most novels that get adapted, he said that to properly tell the full novel, you would need like a 6-episode miniseries, you know, which is also a very common thing to say about a film adaptation in 2014. But the other thing he said is that there's no real main character in A Most Wanted Man. And full disclosure, I've never actually read a Le Carre movie, or sorry, read a Le Carre book. I've watched pretty much all of the movies, and I don't think I ever want to read one of the books because I don't think it's the type of book I would enjoy, but it is absolutely the type of movie that I love. The other main, or the thing that he pointed out, was that there's no real main character in the book, and in their adaptation process they sort of felt like they needed to give an audience something to latch on to, you know. And it's just sort of that's something that's very key, or a key difference between film and novels, is that when you can see the face, especially when in most movies you've seen the lead actor or, you know, the most famous person in something else before, so you're already bringing something to the character. So that's just something where you kind of need a lead character, partially to carry the story, and also partially because of just built-in audience expectations that you have no control over. And I thought that was really interesting, and because it does feel like a movie that comes out of a book with no main character. And you know, Gunther is carrying us through a lot of it, and like you said, there's no antagonist, but Moore is, you know, a quasi antagonist in the way that any hated boss is in a movie, you know, like he's not present a lot, but he's always there, you know. You always are aware of him looking over from above because he's only ever framed from above, Gunther. But it is sort of, I don't know, it feels like you need a Gunther to at least bring you into this world in sort of a film, you know. It would just be a tough sell. It's like even The Wire needs McNulty, you know. And there are a lot of similarities in the storytelling style of this and The Wire. I think there are also a lot of ideological overlap in the two products, but yeah, you just kind of need somebody to introduce you to the world. And even when Gunther kind of goes away for large chunks of the movie, as the story gets turned a bit more over to Thomas for about 5 minutes, and then a bit more over to Annabelle for 10 minutes, you know, it's always going to come back to Gunther. And I think that's a wise decision for the film. And also, it helps that you have one of the finest actors of his generation, you know.
Yeah, what you were saying about just having a sort of a more kaleidoscopic view of characters, it seemed that Issa would just have a more complex drawing of his character. Mm-hmm. You just don't get that chance here. And I mean, he's a bit of an enigma. He doesn't have a ton of lines. He kind of has one emotional scene where he cries silently, you know. Yep. Like, that's his big moment, but that's, you know, it's not chewing the scenery by any means.
Yeah, and the revealing of the scars, and that's pretty much all you get, you know, as far as emotion, right?
I mean, he loses his beard, you know. There is this sort of progression to him. Mm-hmm. as we learn a bit more. And I mean, for a character like this, he's still more complex than a similar character in a more simple film or television show, we can say. But like they point out that he has his contradictions, and that he's something of more than just a caricature. But there's just not the screen time for even Annabelle. I sort of feel the same way. You do get a bit of the cog in the plot machine.
Oh yeah, for sure.
From those two, I found.
There's also a very like old-fashioned writing of women in Le Carre adaptations that Annabelle is the least problematic of, but certainly right. Has elements of, she's this beautiful, innocent girl who is being caught up in this this thing that she knows nothing about, you know. Going back to Issa and how we know, as to use your word, he's sort of an enigma. You know, the movie just starts with him just climbing out of the water. You know, like we don't get an introduction to who he is, and nobody in this movie gets an introduction to who he is. We get what we learn through various, either through security cameras on the train, or what Annabelle learns from the people coming to get her to meet Issa. And it's really interesting, and talking about what I was describing as, like, you're bringing preconceptions to a movie because you've seen these faces before a lot of the times. Issa very clearly, like, was, I mean, I've heard Anton Corbin talk about this, was they cast somebody that they wanted the audience to have had no previous relationship with, which is a smart decision and not, like, the first time this has been done, you know. But I think that that I haven't seen him in anything before, and honestly I haven't seen him in anything since, I think is really helpful for this movie, because nobody really knows anything about Issa except for what they can learn. And like so much of this movie, it's about whether or not they trust that information at all, you know. And yeah. Of all these characters who we don't know a lot about their motives, he's the one we know the least about, and it seems like he might be the most important one, you know. He might be the most important one, or he might not be important at all. That's the thing, you know.
Yeah, and he's seemingly the title character, you know. He's the one that's being pursued the most closely, and that's what makes it so interesting. Mm-hmm. That we have so little information about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And even when, you know, we don't, even at the beginning of the movie, we don't know that he's necessarily going to be the crux of the story, because at that point, Gunther is already following Abdullah. And I think the first person we see him talk to in the movie is Jamal on the phone, who has already been turned, you know, before the movie even starts. Yeah. And that sort of just propulsive aspect of the film is really cool to me. Like, you don't get background on anything. This movie just goes, and it's not really like an action movie, you know. It operates like action movie adjacent, in that so what we're used to seeing spy movies be like would have more action, you know, like the version of A Most Wanted Man directed by Christopher Nolan, you know, is a lot more fast paced, and like the Bond movie version of A Most Wanted Man would have a lot more punching, you know. And this movie just kind of starts, and a lot of times you'll be given a piece of information, like early on when Gunther's guy from Berlin calls him and says the Americans are taking an interest, and him and Erna talking, Gunther and Erna talking about that phone call for maybe 5 seconds, and then we get a hard cut to presumably the next day. We're following Martha into the office from behind as they go to that meeting. You know, it's like, and she's the American. You know, the Americans are taking an interest. Boom. Now we're in the next day. We are seeing that interest, you know, and we don't get any background on Martha. We just go. And that happens a number of times throughout the movie. And I think it's something that can be off-putting to a lot of viewers, but certainly is not to me, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's so much there. It's not the Bond movie. It's not a Bourne movie. And I mean, Le Carré is a British spy author, which, you know, puts them in a category of two extremely famous British spy authors that we know about, you know. And just, he's been on record, and this was more about George Smiley, which is his most famous character, who we get in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and, you know, some of the other of his most famous works. But he's talked about how that's supposed to be the antidote to James Bond, you know, that he thinks Bond is basically a gangster, and instead of traveling around the world and driving super nice cars and killing people glamorously and, you know, having sex with random women, that's not what Smiley does. And it's more about the bureaucracy of things and moving information around and working in dimly lit offices with no windows, you know. And coming from someone who worked for MI5 and MI6, I'm going to take his word that is truly a lot more of what especially the majority of people in the intelligence community are doing, you know, with their workday. And so, yeah, Gunther is not James Bond, you know, by any means. Yeah. He's a different, you know, he's a Philip Seymour Hoffman character. Yeah. not to speak too negatively about the man, but you cast someone like him because you're going for something different. You're going for someone who's more emotionally complex, and just this is someone who is more about playing characters than playing, you know, a cartoon, essentially a cartoon.
Yeah, exactly.
An adult cartoon, but a cartoon. And, you know, and that loops right in with what we were talking about. These aren't stories about good versus bad. You know, there's so much more gray area in here. And that's what we get. And so, by extension, this film, I'm sure there's some pretty beautiful parts of Hamburg. We don't get treated to a lot of them. You know, we get some nice parks where Annabelle's biking around, you know, that look like a nice little leafy place to hang out on a Sunday. But for the most
part... And maybe get kidnapped.
Yeah, until that happens.
Yeah.
But mostly it's these cold blues and, you know, putrid looking yellows and these washed out grays.
The colors in this movie are so gross.
Yeah, no, I know. They're kind of sickening, the yellows. Just cold blues. And, you know, we just get nighttime scenes in red light districts and under bridges where food's being given away. This is not the globe-trotting sunny adventure of, you know, James Bond and anything that's trying to be James Bond. Mm-hmm. And it's not expansive. You know, we get a little bit in Berlin, and then we get conference rooms and in Hamburg. And,
yep,
you know, that's largely it. And we do have that one small chase scene, but it's pretty short.
Yep.
It ends with Gunther just sort of panting out of breath outside, and that's the end of the chase. We've mentioned Annabelle's kidnapping. We barely see guns or violence.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big, like, exciting, intense parts of this is Abdullah signing a document.
Yeah.
Like, that truly is one of the big turns in this movie. And
we see characters watching it happen on screen and reacting like a filmmaker would want their audience to react to an exciting moment in a James Bond movie, you know?
Yeah, like a big action set piece. And even Abdullah, you know, we understand that he's even just the fact, okay, so he's running a shipping company that he's funneling a percent of his donations to hospitals and children's charities, you know, mostly good things, but part of it's going to sell 100 tons of grain to siphon some money off for rocket launchers. Now, granted, that's not good. You know what I mean? That's something that should be stopped. But it's just, there's just not that sexiness to it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
There's not the scene of him firing a rocket launcher to test it at, you know, some kidnapped person. You know what I mean? Like, this movie just is not about that at all. And because it's performed so well and because there's very talented craftspeople putting this all together, you still are engaged. You know, that document signing, I kind of thought it was going to go the other way, and my mind was already racing about like what they do and what the Americans are going to show up. Like, you're still fully engaged in it, but it's just telling a much different story, a much different way. But they do it in such a way that it's still exciting. It's a different kind of exciting, but you're still fully committed.
Yeah. And also one of the first times in the movie where somebody has told you something that's going to happen and then that thing happens, you know, like there's just so little, there are so little predictions made in this movie about what is going to happen, around something that can't be controlled. And that's something where Gunther says, I believe this will happen. And then that is what happens, you know, but then immediately, and I want to leave the last scene till the end, but like then pretty much immediately the unpredictable happens again, you know? So, but yeah, it's all very interesting. And I think the other thing to talk about is, or that we could talk about a little bit, is just intentions, you know? Nobody knows anything about anybody or what they really stand for. Nobody's being honest, for the most part. And nobody knows what anybody's intentions are, you know? Like, and I think that is also interesting, and in that even not knowing what Martha wants to get out of this, you know, like whether or not you know if she's in control, you don't know how she's going to use her control if she has it, you know, and it's just sort of these multiple layers of not knowing, and it's just constant confusion. And I think this is what the film is supposed is wanting to give us, or maybe it's just me being a viewer with 25 years of experience watching Philip Seymour Hoffman and things, but like, it feels like Gunther is the person we can at least believe when he talks and says something, and not when he's talking to necessarily like Jamal or Annabelle to turn them, but it does feel like the movie wanted to give us a character that we can at least believe sometimes, you know? And
yeah, you at least believe his plan about turning people to move up the chain. Like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of ground that.
And also to the majority of people who would see this movie, that makes sense. You know, like there's an element of preaching to the choir there, but it does sort of make sense that, again, coming back to The Wire, like don't just grab the person because they're available. Maybe you can actually do something positive besides looking good for a day, you know? And, and it all makes sense. Like his explanations make sense. And then it's just about whether or not the rest of the people in the boardroom will listen to him. And, almost without exception, the answer is no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those scenes, like in place of violence, the what we have for a lot of our conflict scenes, where instead of a car chase or a gun battle, the conflict is Gunther trying to turn people, you know, like emotionally manipulating Jamal about his father, yeah, or Annabelle, you know, you wanted to be taken, that kind of stuff. That's the conflict that we have. And that's him achieving his goals through, or attempting to achieve his goals through these means. You know, all we have is information and emotion, and that's what we have for our set pieces, and they are really compelling. Mm-hmm. It's he has, you know, the Wire comparison I think is apt there, because yeah, it's not just the stats of getting one arrest per day or whatever. Let's address some of the systematic issues, you know, like, yeah, let's zoom out and do something bigger.
Let's create Hamsterdam and see if we can actually solve something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that you're right to sort of bring in that idea of institutions, and having them, it's tough to get sort of macro and mm-hmm. always have these big goals. And that's why his tiny little, group of people can be a bit more nimble, but you get the sense that American intelligence machine is just sort of an elephant, and it just kind of stomps around and being, instead of being a bit more surgical about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, going back to the sort of that sequence where, or the scene where we're talking, the fish metaphor, and just trying to get to, or maybe being able to believe Gunther's explanation that, they catch little fish, get the big fish. And his explanation that they try to do things from a positive leaning, you know, like he wants to offer the positive over the negative, like offer amnesty instead of threats, you know? And I think that's a pretty key thing that also speaks very clearly to, I think, people like us, you know, that sort of our leaning that doesn't necessarily make sense to bash somebody's head in for 24 hours until they say suspicious things, like what is implied with Issa at the beginning. And when Ernest says, wouldn't anybody start talking after 24 hours? It's just kind of a brief throwaway comment this movie makes about torture in general. It just makes sense, you know, but this movie is so much about how, what can be explained sensibly doesn't always end up happening in practice, you know, due to various people that are in control above, Gunther in this case.
Yeah. And you know, when Martha says, make the world a safer place, it sounds like such a truism that, mm-hmm. you know, let's do anything under that banner. But this movie just illustrates the different ways of doing that and how successful they can be.
Yeah, exactly. And to your point, Gunther in that scene that I was mentioning, the last scene where they are in Berlin, in that scene, in that last boardroom meeting, I believe, he says that line back to her, you know, like looking into her eyes and saying to make the world a better place, like that immediately after giving his explanation on positive over the negative. And it's just, I mean, two sides of the coin basically, and using the same phrase, but having it mean something different, you know, like you can make the world a better place by not beating the shit out of somebody, even, you know? Yeah.
So. We haven't talked about Brew at all yet, Willem Dafoe.
Mm-hmm.
Something of a more straightforward bad guy, the banker with some dark ties. just he's not really the big bad here, so he kind of slips by. And what did you think of his scene when he's at home and drinks his scotch and then throws the ice out? There's not a ton of dialogue, and like a lot of things in this movie, it's not super spelled out. I didn't know what you thought of that.
I mean, it's his view is weird. The view from that financially well-off person looking over on a port seems like a poor decision on where to buy your house. So I think we are supposed to see somebody who, at that point, he's very unsure of what he's doing, or what he's going to do, even with the information that he has, because I think he's pretty early on in his relationship with Issa, and then by proxy Gunther. And I think the fact that what his wife, or who we assume is his wife, mentions to him, here's your, enjoy your scotch, don't trip on your way to bed or whatever, I think that is meant to imply alcoholism. And what alcoholism is in that idea, to use a metaphor, is just sort of this representation of something that you feel like you can't change and that just keeps happening over and over again. And maybe he feels kind of helpless about what he's doing and whether or not what he's doing is actively bad for the world repeatedly. And maybe he has this opportunity to do something that could be good, but also he doesn't know that what he's doing is actually going to be good. So I think it just sort of finds him on this place where he's done a lot of things for a long time, or he's done the same thing for a long time and maybe hasn't seen positive results. And I mean, certainly seen positive financial results, but maybe not, you know, morally, or just he doesn't feel good about what he does. And maybe this is an opportunity to feel a little better about something he does, but also maybe there's still risk. Maybe it's not. Maybe what he's doing is, this is the worst thing that he's ever done, you know, depending on how he plays it. So, and alcoholism is just something that has been with you in theory for a long time, you know, and that you can't shake, and that you want to shake, or that society wants you to shake, you know?
No, I think like a lot of this movie, it's kind of open-ended. So I wanted to know what you thought of that. And also his, you know, we hear Gunther talk about Tommy's attraction to Annabelle, or supposed attraction to Annabelle. And maybe part of it is not entirely physical, in that he sees someone who seemingly just found a career of helping other people, helping strangers in horrible positions, try to get to a better spot in their life. And maybe, I don't know if it's as altruistic as him thinking he should have done something better, or him thinking he's not attractive to Annabelle because he's this person who has this very morally dubious career. Not that everyone who works at a bank is morally dubious, but this particular bank is the case. And and you're right, the alcoholism, I think, is in there. And I kind of want to talk about that through the rest of the movie. And that boat, that idea of this boat just kind of traveling in a straight line and seemingly unstoppable. And in film language, usually right to left is not progress. Mm-hmm. You know, left to right is the way that I've always understood is more positive, more optimistic, and the sign of true progress. And this is a bit more of a regression if we're looking at it through that angle.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. And to go to what you said about Annabelle, number one, I don't think we see Annabelle drink alcohol at any point in the movie. When she's actually offered alcohol, she says water, or says she'll have water. Yeah, exactly. Got to be clear in the Atlantic. And the other thing is, you're right that maybe he sees sort of this altruistic person in Annabelle. But the idea is that they both have money. They're both people with money, and she's able to have an altruistic perspective because she grew up in what is implied, I think, by Gunther, that she grew up with money. And
her father's a judge, and
exactly. And I think that's sort of meant to pair them a bit more closely, and she's just happens to be maybe younger, you know, like she hasn't had as much time to make as many mistakes. And I think the movie wants us to think that this is the first really consequential decision that she gets to make in her life, you know. And
oh, I gotcha.
Sorry?
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, and what Thomas, that's his name, right? Defoe's character. Tommy Brew.
Tommy Brew.
Yeah.
Sounds like a much different person, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like Willem Dafoe in The Lighthouse, not Willem Dafoe in A Most Wanted Man. But what we're seeing with his characterization is maybe somebody who is put off stepping out and making a big decision by just stepping back and just doing what is the easiest option for a long period of time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do we think about Gunther chain smoking and drinking constantly then? Because it kind of sounds like we might need to, like, in your example, your juxtaposition there between Annabelle and Tommy, him drinking, he doesn't drink a lot, but most scenes he's in, I suppose, and that comment by his wife makes it seem like maybe he doesn't have a total grip on it.
Yeah, it seems like he drinks casually while he's outside, or out of his house, and then comes home and goes to town on the scotch before bed. That's sort of the vibe that I get, like he's not out partying or whatever, he's having wine at the Atlantic, but then, to knock himself out, he's gonna have a few scotches before bed.
And it's expected that his wife gives him one within 3 seconds of being inside the door, which
so
is
fast
a lifestyle. Yeah. So we have her not drinking, we have him drinking, we have her being a pretty, I mean, I guess we've talked about how there's a lot of gray here. She seems to play with gray, but we mostly see her in white, mm-hmm. But then Gunther, as I said, chain smoking, drinking constantly. Are we meant to see that as a weakness or a moral failing or someone who kind of is just in something of a rut, maybe in his career, maybe doing things the same way all the time and expecting different results? And then we also just have that other whole lens of Philip Seymour Hoffman's life and of his life, but I don't know if you want to address those one at a time.
So I think what Gunther's consumption of cigarettes and alcohol is I think this is a long-term thing, and I think it is what he does to tolerate what he does. I think he feels like he has an important place in the world, and I think he feels like he has to keep doing this, and he has to keep doing his work. But I just think it's so frustrating to him that he has to keep drinking just to tolerate what he's doing. And I think that's what it is. I just think it's tolerance and putting up with everything that we have to see him deal with throughout this movie. And, there's that moment early on when he meets Martha and he introduces her to Erna. And he says about Erna, she sails and spies. I don't sail.
Yeah.
Which is just like, this is the only thing I do. This is the only thing I care about. outside of maybe 8 notes of piano, we don't see him do anything else. And I just think that he's a, excuse me, he thinks what he's doing is important, and he really does believe in what he's doing. And he's just repeatedly being told by the structure that contains what he does that his ideas are stupid and invaluable, even though he has seen a lot of evidence that the way that structure thinks is not positive.
Yeah,
he's like Robert De Niro at the end of Raging Bull, just punching the wall repeatedly, and his hands hurt, so he needs the alcohol to keep being able to punch the wall, because there's no way out beyond punching through this wall.
Yeah, I think, again, we've talked about the lack of black and whites. I think he thinks he is a white hat. Like, I think he thinks he's doing the right thing, but can do bad things, means to an end sort of thing. He can kidnap Annabelle and keep her against her will in a place and lie to her.
Just constant emotional manipulation. Like, I'm not saying he's a hero by any means. Like, he has to emotionally manipulate basically everybody in this movie that he deals with, from Jamal continually, and Annabelle, Thomas, basically everybody that he turns, and also emotionally manipulating Issa through Annabelle by saying words that she says to him.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think he thinks he's doing what he's doing for the right reasons. He's willing to do bad things for the right reasons. And it just feels, yeah, like there's no sort of halfway with him. Like, there's no half-assing anything in his life. And mm-hmm. I don't think he takes time off. So he so he kind of just lives both lives at once. You know, he doesn't punch out at five and then have a drink.
I don't think he punches out.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. Exactly. Like, I think he's working every second that he's awake. So if that means he's also drinking on the clock, that's fine. But, like, this is who he is. This is his life. This is his compulsion to work,
yeah.
To try to make the world a safer place. And he's as committed to that as, like, he just doesn't have the off switch, whether that comes with his intelligence work or with his drinking and smoking 19 cigarettes. Mm-hmm. That's just sort of who he is. And again, that lends to look at this being his last, you know, starring role, mm-hmm. in how close it is to his real death. Just cast such a tone on this. And I mean, it's, you could see this movie and not know that's the case, you know, because he looks kind of similar in the last, you know, decade of his life, and he looks schlubby in this, but he's sort of meant to by design.
Yeah. He sounds really unhealthy in a way that, like, his, you hear a lot of Gunther breathing in this movie that is edited out of a lot of movies. And I think that, it could have been a choice, you know, and, could have been a choice on set. And it feels like it does really convey the sort of continually defeated side of Gunther that we're talking about.
Yeah, and even, like, he's just always slouched or hunched over, and just, again, we talked about how this is his compulsion, like, just his shoulders, he has the weight of the world, mm-hmm. whether that's true or not, he certainly acts like he does.
Yeah.
Through self-medicating, through his posture, through his breathing, and for there's super small moments of levity in this movie, like, very, very fleeting. And it's because Philip Seymour Hoffman did have this charisma and this capability of being so funny.
Yeah.
He certainly doesn't do it in big ways like we've seen him do it in other movies in this movie, just because of the nature of the stories that we're telling and the characters we're dealing with and the tone of it. Even with this subject matter, it's just still so bitter and gray.
Yeah, because, like, we've talked about this before, he's basically, like, our generation's equivalent of Robert Duvall, who is has movie star charisma, but just because casting directors are like, he looks like a regular person, gets cast in smaller roles, you know? And they're still, like, the most handsome version of a regular person that has existed, you know? And it's just this weird sort of disconnect between reality and how Hollywood views reality.
He's always so good at being a fully realized character, and in real life there are tiny funny things, and it's so amazing that just, like, flickers across the screen so quickly, and you buy this character that you've spent 10 minutes with. And again, that does, as you said, it comes with having seen this person before, but it is amazing how a character like this can still have, like, this little moment of something where you're just like, oh yeah, okay, that's funny. Okay, now what's happening with the, you know, Islamic terrorism thing?
Yeah, and in a movie that gives you so little tangible things to grab onto, like somebody who gives you a lot with a performance, but none of which is tangible. You know, like, you can't explain why you love watching Philip Seymour Hoffman all the time. Certainly there are moments where you can, and but, like, acting is so ethereal in general, and it's just, like, he's one of the people we all agree is amazing. And, like, there's nobody on the other side of that fence who disagrees, you know? And, like, there are very few examples of people who everybody considers as a great actor, you know?
And that was true before he died. Like,
100%.
It wasn't just the afterglow where someone dies and everyone has to pretend they really liked him. Like, you'd ask somebody in 2012, or if you asked 100 people what they thought of Philip Seymour Hoffman in 2012, you'd get maybe not quite as glowing response, but it'd be pretty unanimous.
Yeah, I mean, by 2005, I think it's unanimous, if not before then.
I just meant not 2014, but yeah.
But yeah, and I think just to go back to what you were saying about Gunther, or sorry, what we were saying about Gunther and alcohol, using alcohol as tolerance, I think something that's really important to point out is that we see him drinking during the day as well. When he's with Martha, and it looks like that's a morning meeting. I don't think they really establish whether it is, but like they're meeting for coffee. So I think the visual language tells us it's a morning meeting, and that's something where...
It's not 5 o'clock. I'll tell you that much.
That's sort of like a scene that's important for the whole drinking for tolerance thing, because I think a lot of the time when you see characters drink a lot in movies that also do these jobs that where they work around the clock, just from a practical side of it, if you had Gunther's job, had to work around the clock, you would drink coffee constantly, and you would just need to drink alcohol to make yourself fall asleep. Like, it just that's the way that the body works, you know, like a lot of the time. And I think that a lot of the functional alcoholism we see from characters in these kinds of movies makes more sense, just because of the lives they lead. But with Gunther, it is clearly because he's drinking all day, like it's purely to tolerate the world that he's in.
Yeah. And in that scene, that breakfast coffee scene, whatever, there is that kind of funny exchange about old habits dying hard, and on the topic of alcoholism, it's fitting. And a lesser movie has a bit of dialogue where one person walks away and then the other person says something to themselves out loud about not really trusting them, or something. Yeah, and it's just like, okay, good, thank you for not doing this. We've seen this we've seen this scene enough, and we know it's being conveyed here, and we know these people are too smart, and that's not how people talk,
for sure. And one last thing that I think I really want to mention quickly with Gunther, and because I think this is really important for his characterization, is that sequence where, or scene where he's in the bar with Robin Wright, or sorry, Martha, and he sees the man and the woman dancing, and the man hits the woman, and he just immediately gets up and hits him. And when she tells him, when the woman who got hit tells him it's okay, his response to her is, it's okay, like he's shocked by it. And I think that's really important to understanding Gunther, and that he's somebody who, once he sees something, he has to act on it immediately, whether, you know, what he does in his job is he knows he has to act a bit slower than just getting up and walking across the room and hitting somebody,
but he does something.
Exactly. And I think, and then he's shocked by somebody not agreeing with his action, you know. And I think that's sort of that's something that a lesser actor and a lesser movie doing really couldn't sell. And I think there's a number of things in this movie that a lesser version of this movie just, it would make me roll my eyes. But that's one that I think really speaks to how Gunther reacts to the world around him. You know, he sees something and he has to do something. And while we're talking about scenes shared between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Robin Wright, Robin Wright's great in this movie. You know, Robin Wright is always very good. And there's nothing in this performance that I didn't see in House of Cards. You know, like, she's not a chameleon, I don't think, but perfect casting and perfect performance. You know, like, I think she's so good. And I think a lot of this movie and a lot of what you get out of this movie, from a sort of meaning standard or standpoint, comes through conversations that her and Gunther are having. And you're standing toe to toe with Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, and it's just, that's great. And I like, that's tough, and she's great, you know? And I think that she is, she's somebody who's really good at delivering important dialogue in a very measured way. You know, I think that's probably her greatest skill. And I think they work really well together for that reasoning.
And
also being mysterious. Amazing at being mysterious.
And she just does not have a lot of screen. Like, she has less screen time than you would guess in this movie. Just,
yeah.
She just manages to do a lot with very little.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So I sort of hinted at things that a lesser movie would do that would be annoying. Or sorry, things that this movie does that a lesser movie would make annoying. The constant mention of fathers and sons in this movie, I think, like, absolutely is just like walking the line of being too much, but for some reason it just works, or never goes too far. And I think part of that is the stylistic choice of this movie, in that I think with the exception of like one or two helicopter shots, everything is handheld. And the idea for that seems to be just to, you know, like so many movies that are primarily handheld, is to sort of make you feel like you're there, or to just sort of give a more boots on the ground feeling to the movie. And I think that really helps sell, some of the more, the grander, like classic Hollywood things that are present in a lot of Licari adaptations. And I think to sort of treat this not quite from a documentary style perspective, but to sort of let you feel the perspective of being in this world from the camera on the shoulder physically moving, you know, I think that was a really smart choice, you know?
Yeah, and lines up with what we were saying about this just being more about character than action, and more about just Licari's interest in these people being the human functionaries of policy than it is about policy, or, you know, it's more about battles than wars, and always has been. And I think that's what the handheld look gets across. And it's not the Jason Bourne handheld, just because we're not shooting the same type of action, you know, but it gets across that personal sense, I think, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Like the difference between documentary style, Jason Bourne type stuff, and this is like a lot of zooms, which is specifically meant to indicate documentary feeling. Because if there are any zooms in this movie, I can't think of them. And I can think of about 50 off the top of my head in the Bourne Ultimatum.
Yeah.
But like the idea of, you know, Jamal is spying on his own father, and the way that Gunther is set up as his surrogate father, and Issa wanting to give the money away to theoretically repair some of the sins his father has done. Just all of these
Tommy Brew's father is the banker who did business with...
Exactly. The connection between Tommy and Issa is a letter between their fathers, you know? Yeah. And so there is this real generational aspect, and I think it ties into the idea of waves, like the effect of your decision. What is the wave of your existence? It is your child, you know? And I think on a even bigger scale than that, the idea being that decisions that all of these countries are making right now will have implications on future generations, you know? And it all comes back to the opening shot, like the idea of waves, like all of these actions will down the line have some sort of effect. And I just think that it's these really grand, broad ideas, but something about the close style of the filmmaking just sort of ties it, makes it seem smaller than it actually is. You know, it's like just these big grand orchestral ideas that could exist on screen, but they just sort of keep it close to the ground, and I like that a lot.
Yeah, and even in, who knows if this is just emotional manipulation, but Gunther's idea that Annabelle's doing this to piss off her father, you know, even if it's, you know, that would seem a bit more unpredictable, you know, the fact that her father's a judge and she wants to be someone fighting sort of against the system. You know, it's not completely predictable what your impact's going to be, how those dominoes fall, what those waves end up doing or being like. But there is just that unforeseen or unforeseeable effect of what you've done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's, I don't know if you want to loop this right into the closing, but we don't get a mention of Gunther's family, and that maybe some of these things just peter out and they don't have this domino effect if the larger institution manages to quash them successfully. You know, if all this work that he's done or is trying to do is undone by a more powerful force, then his effect might stop being felt in the world.
Yeah, so absolutely. And yeah, you mentioned the last scene. Like, so I remember watching this movie for the first time. I saw it in theaters, and I remember I was conscious of the fact that I was enjoying this movie, and then like the last scene happened, and I was conscious of the fact that I loved the ending of this movie. It is like an all-time pulling the chair out from you. It feels very, it's so old-fashioned in the way that I feel like, you know, like a lot of really great movies from the 50s and 60s don't feel like they're about to end and then they end, you know? And I feel a lot of times like modern movies go on one scene too long. And I know that's kind of a glib thing to say because you're not really necessarily looking at things from the filmmaker's full intention, but a lot of movies have one extra scene to explain what happened in the climax. And I think a recent example of that is the movie One Night in Miami, which I liked, but has one scene too many because it ends with a really beautiful shot that sort of implies everything that the next scene would tell. And that's also a little bit more complicated because it's about four very famous historical figures. But what A Most Wanted Man does is just like, it makes you feel like Gunther finally is doing something, like finally everything he's doing is positive, and then it's just gone. He has like maybe 10 seconds of feeling accomplishment, or at least the potential to feel accomplishment as he takes Abdullah to go try to turn him. And it is, and just the way that we finally see Gunther break down, Philip Seymour Hoffman, like throughout his career, doesn't do a lot of like big moments like screaming fuck in the middle of the street and just the grossest sounding wheeze you've ever heard in your life. And the way that he then just sort of like walks over to Erna and they just look at each other and just have nothing to say. And I don't know what this movie is supposed to get from us watching Gunther walking off. Like, I don't know if we're supposed to think that, or walking off screen and then the cutting to black. I don't know that we're supposed to think necessarily that he's walking off screen and just like going to go cry and then go back to the office and start anew because he believes so firmly in that. I don't know that it wants us to think that he's walking to the office to go quit. I think that's the right idea to have. I don't think this movie wants us to think that it's giving us an answer. But just to really go all the way with never telling your audience everything is just, that's really bold. And you could feel the silence in the movie theater of people being like, that's the end. And you know, like that tends to be, I know I've mentioned this recently on a podcast, but that tends to be something that just, that feeling, like you just cannot put a dollar value on that to me. Like No Country for Old Men is one of the great examples of that, because that's a movie that people saw in full theaters and you could feel that in a theater, Inception or something like that. And it's just, man, it's cool, you know? And it's just the confidence it takes on all aspects of production to be like, this is our idea. And then to think about it and continue to act on it for a year and a half and never change your mind is so cool and so bold. And you feel defeated like Gunther does. And I think it just communicates to us what the movie has been trying to do all along. You know, we talked about waves at the beginning, the first shot, and just sort of how that's the effect of the cause of moving through water. And the effect of having watched A Most Wanted Man and being wrapped up in A Most Wanted Man is that stunned silence when it cuts to black, when most movies wouldn't cut to black. You know, you get a debrief and Martha saying why she did what she did. And you don't get any of that. You just get the person in the balcony that you assumed was an asshole, continues to be an asshole. the person who you didn't know if you could trust, but were maybe starting to trust, turns out you can't trust her. And she drives off in her car. And the person that you thought that piece of satisfaction that you got from being right, and the theoretical idea of further satisfaction from being able to turn him and continuing your plan to turn Abdullah and maybe go for an even bigger fish, that gets taken away from you immediately. And you get to the point where the person that we see him most often with Erna, they just look into each other's eyes and they just have no words. You know, like there's just nothing. They're on the same page. And she's the closest thing to family that we see for him in this movie. And there's just nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and
he touches her arm several times, which is affection as far as Gunther's concerned.
The few jokes that he makes that I believe you were talking about earlier, I think are all directed to her. You know,
like,
yeah, and
with her, about her. Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. I think that this movie conveys broken humanity in that scene in a way that is just so difficult. And
yeah. Ugh. Well, I think the Inception comparison can be instructive in the difference between the two, because I think with Inception, it's sort of like more pyramidal, like it goes up and then down. And it is kind of a gut punch, you know, like you can still remember what it's like.
Yeah, that's sort of like, that's more of the magic trick sort of thing.
I was just going to say, that's a trick. Like this is like, kind of demeans it too much, but that's sort of the gimmick of that. It's like, oh, you thought this, and then like they just kind of slip it out. This is just like truncation. Like this is just, you were expecting something more and this just like trailed off. Mm-hmm. And again, I love this ending, so I don't mean that in a pejorative way. Just like when he gets hit by the car, you're like, something is not right in this movie where I couldn't predict everything, like what the fuck was that?
Oh yeah, and you don't think that car is gonna hit when it does?
No, you know? No, not at all. Like I saw the car speeding up. I was like, okay, what's up here? You don't think he's gonna get hit? And silly me, there's a brief moment when he's looking at Erna that I thought it might be clear that she had something to do with it, like sold him out or something.
Yeah.
But you don't get like that. Kind of comes and goes. Personal perspective. And yeah, there's just nothing to be said. She knows how important this is to him. There's nothing she can really say. There will be something eventually, I'm sure. Even with German reticence, I'm sure she'll express some kind of emotion about what just took place at a later date in a level tone of voice. But yeah, he drives and then he pulls over and you don't know where he's pulling over. No. And he walks off frame at a weird angle. And then the music starts. And then, you know, after a movie like this is done, I start doing my research about it. And one of the top hits is like a most wanted man ending explained. I'm like, oh no. There's no point in reading that. There's no explanation for this. Yeah. As you said, that's, just that feeling of broken humanity, the things we were talking about, you know, this being about more about battles than wars, this being more about, you know, character driven than action driven. The way that Inception is sort of that magic trick designed to have an ending like that.
Yeah.
This is just a reflection of human experience where you just draw a line wherever you want, and that's where the story ends. There's no bow. Like, there's such a bow on Inception, as much as it's ambiguous.
It's the bow of all bows. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's the bow of all bows. But this is just like, now the movie's done. Deal with that. That's what life's like. And that's what Gunther's life is.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the closest thing to closure that I get out of this movie is the... So there's a bit of, like, score music that comes back in as he's driving off and through the opening of the end credits. Like there's a score happening while the document is being signed, and then it sort of stops as once the car crashes into Gunther, and we just are forced to just hear another sort of like them trying to inject more reality into this movie than is really possible with filmmaking. Just the screaming of Annabelle, the sound of Issa's head hitting the pole. You just are the artifice sort of, as much as it's possible, sort of falls away, and then the music comes back when he's looking at Erna. That's when we start to hear the orchestra again, and we get that through the beginning of the credits. And then I totally forgot that this was the song that they chose, but when I was watching it again probably a few weeks ago, out of general curiosity, I was like, when Hoist That Rag started, the Tom Waits song, I was just like, that's an amazing song choice, because that's from Real Gone, which is, I think, Tom Waits' first album post 9/11. And it's very much like a War on Terror album, and that is the most War on Terror song, you know, like, and just the idea of hoist that rag, the rag being the flag, and just sort of like the idea of fighting for nationalism in any, or sorry, fighting for a nation or anything like that. And also just the way that Tom Waits sounds, and even more so than most Tom Waits songs, like he's really leaning into the more gravelly aspects of his voice. And I think the idea that we're supposed to get from that choice of song is that Gunther is still going to, he'll be back in the office soon enough. You know, he has no sailboat to go to, and, yeah. But his voice is just going to continue to sound more and more gravelly, and this is going to destroy him eventually. Like if it hasn't already, it will. Yeah.
The epic drinking binge he'll go on between now and when he goes back in the office. Will only make his voice more Tom Waitsy. But I think you're right. Like as awful as that was, I don't get the sense that he's ever just gonna throw in the towel and like sell jeans or whatever.
What else is he gonna do? And that conversation that he has with Martha when he's describing like that's where they're talking about why do we do what we do, all the damage we leave behind, all those lives. It's like the idea that he does feel almost haunted, you know, and by people who have died. We didn't even mention the thing that's hinted at in Beirut, where he is responsible for people's deaths. And it seems like that haunts him, even though the movie touches on it for maybe 15 seconds. And I think that's just sort of part of what gives him the inner compulsion to continue doing what pretty much every observer of this movie would guess is an impossible task.
Yeah.
But making a really good movie out of an impossible task turns out to not be an impossible task. Because The Most Wanted Man was fantastic. But yeah, thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man, and check back next time.